All right, good.
Okay, so it's supposed to be pedagogical and do interrupt, but we will try not to get sidetracked also. Okay, so actually this full title is Beginner's Guide to Hopf Algebras and Non-Abelian Statistics, which is what I want to make contact with non-abelian statistics by the end of the talk. So where are we going to head with this? So at least to begin with, we'll talk about symmetry. How do we describe symmetry in physics? Well, in classical physics, I think arguably symmetries are described by groups. So we're all familiar with groups, and in classical mechanics, if we have a solid body, we can start thinking about rotating it, and we have a group of rotations, and we can think about the symmetry that way. We may also have discrete symmetries. But in quantum physics, on the other hand, I'll argue that the proper description of symmetry is not groups in general, but algebras, associative algebra. So I'll explain what that is in a little bit. And a Hopf algebra is an example of an associative algebra, an associative algebra, so a Hopf algebra, any particular Hopf algebra, and it's an associative algebra, but it's also got some extra structure that we'll define for some purposes in addition. And at least according to some authors, what they define as a quantum group is nothing but a Hopf algebra. Although I guess other people might define a quantum group a bit more narrowly. The Hopf algebra structure provides a very natural setting in which to describe quantum numbers and statistics of particles. And some examples before we get going, some of which I'll explain and some of which I won't in this talk, but just to throw out some names, groups or finite groups in particular can be turned into Hopf algebras. So can Lie algebras. So can the quantum groups you might have heard of, quantized universal enveloping algebras. Also Yangians you might have heard of. You might have heard of quantum doubles of various things around here if you've been reading some of the papers that are being discussed here. And also, arguably, things like the Temple-Lieb algebra are also can be turned into Hopf algebras, or at least closely related. Okay, so those few words are just by way of introduction. It is a bit of a mathematical subject, so if you actually wanted to study this seriously, you would first have to do a bit of background reading with some algebra text. You need something like graduate, first or second year math graduate student algebra. Well, you know, all physicists acquire a certain amount of math anyway, but not quite at the sufficient level, perhaps. So you could try my colleague Serge Lang's text on algebra. Actually, my preference is my late colleague Nathan Jacobson's two-volume text.
And people... What are the prerequisites for this?
Huh?
What are the prerequisites for studying these?
Just, you know, ordinary just algebra. It's just abstract algebra, that's all. But I mean, this starts... So that...
Could cost analysis is enough? Or...
No, you don't need analysis. You only need algebra. There's no analysis involved here at all. I completely avoid analysis. No calculus. So people tend to make jokes about the title of this text, especially when they get to volume two. volume one is pretty easy going, really. That would be the background, but then for Hopf algebras, assuming you have some backgrounds, I've been using Charlie and Presley's book for some time, and more lately, also, I've been looking at a book by Castle, also entitled Quantum Groups. Okay. All right. So now let's start to talk about symmetry in a quantum system, basically internal symmetries, so not really thinking about so much things moving around in space and time, but just doing some kind of internal operations. And to make it definite, let's suppose that we've got some quantum system, a few degrees of freedom, and we've got some Hamiltonian, which of course is Hermitian. And if we want to ask for the symmetry of this Hamiltonian, we can ask for the set of operators that commute with this Hamiltonian. Okay, and just from this definition, you can easily verify that the operators that commute with some given Hamiltonian will obey the following axioms which define an associative algebra over the complex numbers, since we're in physics here. So, so there are always these rather simple-looking axioms that come up, and this time we'll actually just write some of these out. So if we have elements A1 and A2, so in quantum mechanics these would be some operators, and also we can throw in a complex coefficient here. If these A1 and A2 are in the algebra, then A1 plus lambda A2 is also going to be in the algebra. So if these commute with the Hamiltonian, this combination also commutes with the Hamiltonian. Zero will be in the algebra. Okay, other exciting axioms to follow, which won't take very long. okay, there's also going to be a unit element. One, that's more important. So apart from the unit, so the first axioms just say that the algebra is a vector space. And now we get into some multiplicative structure, which I should have mentioned before coming to the unit, I suppose. So we have an algebra, not just a vector space. So with our elements A1 and A2, we have some product, which is in the algebra. And then we have also, in particular, a unit, 1, which has the property that 1 times A equals A times 1 equals A. Okay, and very importantly, the product is associative. This is why it's called an associative algebra. For any A1, A2, and A3. It's also distributive over addition. I think I'll spare you that one. And that's about it. Okay, so these are things that really everybody already knows. Okay, we've all been dealing with algebra since childhood. In the case of quantum mechanics, we've got one other structure actually on this algebra. We've got the adjoint operation, because in quantum mechanics we're working with a positive definite Hilbert space or vector space, so we can use that inner product to define an adjoint. And not only do all of the elements I've mentioned here commute with the Hamiltonian, but also if A is a member of the algebra, then A dagger is also a member of the algebra. It also commutes with the Hamiltonian. And this dagger or star operation turns the algebra into what's called a star algebra. Which just means that we have this operation that behaves in the way that the adjoint behaves. Okay, so now, now we come to representation theory of the algebra. So the states of the Hamiltonian fall into representations, that is, the eigenstates of a given energy, are in representations of A. So A acts as matrices. So a representation of A is a vector space V. And then we've got, if A is a member of A and V is a member of V, then A times V is also a member of V. And we have some other relations such as these, which are all reasonably obvious. Okay, so then we can come to a meaty looking theorem. Well, I've just collected together all the standard facts about these things. So the representations of a star algebra are fully decomposable into direct sums of irreducible representations. So we can write V as a direct sum of some irreducible representations VI. And then we would say that all representations are semi-simple. Okay. And well, that's sort of the first part of the theorem. And the second part of the theorem then describes the structure of the algebra itself. The algebra itself basically consists of block diagonal matrices. Just a second. So the algebra can be written as a, well, I guess it's really a direct product of some blocks which are where here MN is the algebra of complex matrices, N by N matrices. So in other words, what this says is that if I write down all of the, any element of A is something with elements only in some square blocks on the diagonal. And the sizes of these blocks are the dimensions of the irreducible representations. Okay, so once you've seen this, you really know everything about the algebra and the representations. Yes?
So we're talking about finite dimensional representations.
Yes, in fact, we'll probably pretend we're talking about finite dimensional algebras, although most of it goes over. Yeah. Any other questions?
Yeah. All of this, what you said so far, appears extremely trivial. I mean, why do you need
yes.
to read those books to learn about it?
You don't. Well, this would be this. You know, this would be like this is chapter 2 of volume 1. Okay, but it will. Don't worry, it will get. We'll get more challenging in a minute. If you can spot what I haven't done yet.
Okay.
Yeah, Alexei.
When you talk about representations of a star algebra, you probably assume that the star operation corresponds to the Hermitian conservation.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there are going to be various things like this that I don't explicitly say, which, if, strictly speaking, are okay. assumed or even necessary for the correctness of the statements that follow. But I won't bother you with all the details in the talk. So, yeah.
But when you define star algebra, you do not assume any positivity, like sister algebra, this kind of condition.
You're really assuming some positivity, I guess, yeah, which I haven't stated. So, I mean, many of my definitions don't require, the theorem certainly requires it, but many of the definitions apply to algebras that don't have to be star algebras. Some of them do assume basically what we have in quantum mechanics, which is that we've got a positive definite inner product on the vector space with the adjoint operation. So if you keep that in mind, you won't really go wrong with anything in the talk.
Okay.
In most cases, unless I tell you otherwise. All right, any other? Okay, so that's basically algebras. One other thing I wanted to tell you, let's see. So algebras can be defined by generators and relations. So you might have some particular set of elements of the algebra, and then you have some relations, which are basically algebraic expressions in some of these generators. Okay. So then, in other words, these are the generators. You're allowed to any arbitrary elements of the algebra would be linear combinations of products of elements which are generators, products of generators, and algebraic expressions can be sometimes replaced by other algebraic expressions. Okay, so that's a useful way to define algebras. If you're brave, you could make the relations include transcendental functions, I suppose, but that's... the other general point I want to make is that when we talk about representations of anything, really, in quantum mechanics, especially in things that I can think of, we always do it by mapping them into associative algebras. So really, anytime we do representations, we're always working with associative algebras. Okay, so now I'll give you examples, familiar examples, which illustrate how what I just said actually works. So the first example, let's suppose you have a finite group. Finite group is not an algebra as it stands. When we talk about representations of the group, really what we do is we turn it into an algebra in the following way. So of course the group means that we have any elements in the group. We have product, which is a member of the group. We also have an inverse for any element equal to 1. So I should have said we have a unit element in the group as well. Okay. So what we do is we define the group algebra of the group C of G, which consists of linear combinations of group elements. Okay, so AGs are just complex numbers, coefficients, and then it's clear that these form a vector space, which the algebra should be a vector space. We just add these and collect coefficients, or we multiply by scalars in the obvious way. And we turn it into an algebra by defining the product, and the product is defined using the product in the group. So we just take any two of these linear combinations. We can multiply these H, I think I'm using some other combination, B sub H, and this can be written as, if we gather things together a little bit, we can sum over G and H such that G times H equals G prime, gather those coefficients, and then we've got this element G prime, which comes from the G times the H. So this has the same form as the elements I started with, linear combinations of group elements.
Now here G should be a C on the line, right? H equals 1. And G is a complex number.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. All right, so that's the group algebra. And for finite groups like this, this has the property that it's a, well, it's a finite dimensional algebra. And it's also a semi-simple algebra, so everything I said can be turned into a star algebra, in fact. And so all the things I said here apply to finite groups. And this is all the stuff you learn in the course on group representation theory.
We never add group elements this way.
We do when we look at the group algebra. And when you have a representation of a group, which is a vector space, you actually, there's nothing to stop you taking complex linear combinations of, if you like, in the representation, you could say the matrices that represent any group element. Okay, so really, the way you can think about group representation theory is this way. Okay, now at the end, you could say, okay, once I know the representations, I could just look at the matrices for each group element, try to forget the algebra, but it's useful to keep the algebra in mind.
In what physical situation would I want to take that sum over group elements?
Well, the physical, this is, yeah, right.
I don't. Representation of the symmetry of the pieces, you'll multiply by certain elements on the left, which are interesting elements of the group algebra.
Yeah.
What are they called? They're written C sub lambda, but anyway, there.
Yeah. I mean, this is the mathematical analysis of the group, of course. It doesn't directly correspond to some. But indeed, when you're analyzing it, you certainly want to have these things available. And only using group elements wouldn't really be enough. And that's Mike's point as well.
But it should be completely obvious to physicists, because all you're doing is quantizing the group, right? I mean, it's not the classical states are the group elements, and you're looking at the formal linear combinations. What could be more natural? Just think of it as
it's not the way we think of it, though. Yeah.
It is natural. Okay. That linear combination can be used with H.
Once you're at a major,
yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
No, I mean, Sumir accepts this natural. He's asking, what is it good for? Which is a totally different question.
Well, see, once you say this, you can immediately use this general theory over here, and you've immediately got everything. You can do a little character theory as well, but that's the same thing. All the stuff that you learn in group theory applies, in fact, to general semi-simple algebras. It's the same theory, yes.
Question, maybe you said this already, but what is the definition of semi-simple?
Well, let's see. So semi-simple for representations means you can, which is supposed to be finite dimensional anyway, you can decompose into a direct sum. For algebras, finite dimensional algebra is semi-simple when it decomposes into blocks like this.
So can I ask also, this is kind of like, Hilbert space, a basis of vector labeled by the group elements.
Exactly, yes, that's exactly what this is. But then we not only have a vector space, we can define a product on this vector space, which turns it into an algebra. Okay, so that's finite groups. And then we have Lie algebras. And here we may have the inverse situation of Sabir's question, because here physicists always work with the corresponding associative algebra and forget the distinction with the Lie algebra. So the Lie algebra, I don't know whether I should try this or not, but how many people think a Lie algebra is an associative algebra? Except in general cases, a Lie algebra is not an associative algebra. It's definitely non-associative. So what you have in a Lie algebra is you have, call this curly G here. So this is a vector space. And when we turn it into we'll say it's got a basis of elements Ji, okay? Just a basis for this vector space. And we'll turn it into a non-associative algebra by defining a Lie bracket, where you take two of these things and this gives some linear combination of these basis elements. And the Lie bracket has the properties that it's bilinear, anti-symmetric, And it obeys the Jacobi identity. Okay. But it's not associative.
Should I sum over K?
Yeah, I'm summing over K. Okay. So, for example, this could be Jx, Jy, and Jz, and we have the Lie algebra of SL2 or SU2. And I'm, again, working with complex coefficients here. So this is not an associative algebra. It could be finite dimensional, incidentally, as is SU2. Viewed as a Lie algebra, it's finite dimensional. Then we can turn it into an associative algebra called the universal enveloping algebra, or UEA for short, U of G. And in this, the basis elements are going to be strings of formal products of these J's, some finite length. In fact, we can use the JIs as generators algebraically, taking sums and products, generators for the algebra, and we'll define relations, which of course are commutation relations, that have the same form as the Lie bracket up there. So now we've got a set of generators and relations, and that defines an associative algebra. But this is going to be an infinite dimensional algebra, even when the underlying Lie algebra is finite dimensional. And this is why Lie algebra theory is a bit more tricky than finite group representation theory, because now you have infinitely many, typically you have infinitely many finite dimensional representations, you also have infinite dimensional representations, and all that stuff. However, it is semi-simple again. At least under the correct definition of semi-simple for the infinite dimensional algebra case.
Do you assume this formal product to be associative here?
Yes, that's right. So we're making it an associative algebra by construction. Right, thank you. Okay, so we can again fully decompose representations here, stuff again you learn in graduate quantum mechanics, you learn how to do this for SU2. And there you tend to forget the distinction between the Lie algebra, which is a rather abstract thing, and the way these operators act in some Hilbert space. And implicitly, you work in the universal enveloping algebra there. Okay, so that's the end of those examples for the time being. I'll come back to them. So now the next thing to do is I'm going to reformulate the algebra axioms or definitions. And this is not just for the sake of being obscure, it's for the sake of generalizing and making a certain duality hopefully more clear in a minute. Well, we've got various definitions. The main thing we want to look at is the product. So we can think of the product as a bilinear map from the tensor product of the algebra with itself into the algebra. So since the algebra is a vector space, we can take its tensor product with itself. And then we can look at a linear map, all my maps are implicitly linear, into the algebra. And the definition of this map using elements, I take a pair of elements from A tensor A, and this is nothing but A1 times A2. That's a complicated way of writing down the product. But now we can also write something for associativity. So associativity means we're going to look at three elements, so we can write down the triple tensor product of A with itself. We actually don't have to worry about where the brackets go in this because we can use some canonical isomorphisms and identify, and that's not a problem at all. And then what we can do is we can multiply elements in two different ways. We could multiply the first two first, or we could multiply the last two first. So we could, in terms of these maps, then this will give us a map into A tensor A, whichever way we do it. And we can think of that map as mu tensor, the identity map. So mu acts here on the first two, and the last element is left alone. On the other side, we could act on the last two with mu. And then, of course, we can just multiply these elements together, and we'll get an element of A. And now the question is, if we do it in these two different fashions, do we get the same answer or not? So then we say that the diagram commutes if these maps that go from the same starting point to the same finishing point are equal as maps. So the diagram commutes actually means that for all A1, A2, and A3, in this notation with mu, I get something a bit complicated, like mu of A1, A2, A3 equals mu of A1, mu, A2, A3. Okay, so that says that applying these maps basically twice, which closely follows this diagram, gives the same result for any A1, A2, and A3. But this is just nothing but saying that A1, A2, A3 equals A1, A2, A3 with the brackets as shown. Okay. So this is another way to state same old idea of associativity. And similarly, the things like the unit element in the algebra, the 1, can be written as in terms of a map as well. And one more thing we can write in terms of a map is, which I haven't mentioned up to this point, is I could ask about whether the algebra, the product, is commutative or not. So in terms of elements, we would say A1, A2 equals A2, A1. If this is true for all A1, A2, then the algebra is commutative. We can write this in terms of some map. Sigma maps A tensor A to A tensor A. And on elements, what it does is it maps the pair A1, A2, or A1 tensor A2, goes to A2 tensor A1. Okay. And then we can write a diagram again where we actually multiply the things and we can say that they commute. That is the diagram. Here that's the diagram that commutes but represents the commutation of the product. So we can either flip them using sigma and then multiply them, or we can just multiply them and forget about sigma, in which case this map at the bottom is just the identity. And if we say this diagram commutes, the maps going around the two different routes are equal, that means that for all A1 and A2, we have this identity, which is commutativity. Okay, so algebraists like to write things in terms of commuting diagrams.
You always assume A1, A2 commute.
No, I'm saying that the definition of commutative algebra is that for all A1 and A2, the product in each order is the same. But I'm not just going to talk about commutative algebras. Okay, so this is just a very heavy notation for writing simple definitions of commutative, but we will generalize in a second. Okay, so so far we haven't done much except describe algebras, associative algebras. So now, but there's one, and their representations. But there's one thing that we haven't done yet with our representations. We haven't described how to analyze a tensor product of representations. Okay. So where would that come up? Why would we want to do that? Well, if we've just got one quantum mechanical system, maybe a molecule or something, and let's assume we're interested in states rather than operators in the space. If we just want to analyze the states, we can just use the representation theory that I've described up to now. We look at the what commutes with the Hamiltonian, we work it all out. If we only got one physical copy of our system, we're never going to have to look at a tensor product of different states. However, if our system is a particle, and we've got two of these particles, maybe they come rather close together, they start to interact, now we really have to deal with how this thing transforms. What is the symmetry under the algebra? We've presumably got one algebra that describes the symmetry of our system, whether the particles are interacting or not. Now, so one thing you could do is you could say, well, I can let the algebra act on all the states of A, and I can also, of one system, and I can also let the algebra act on the other system separately, independently. That would be fine if the particles are not interacting. Okay, that would be a symmetry of distinguishable particles anyway, if they're not interacting. But in general, they're interacting, and all you've got is the symmetry of the whole Hamiltonian. You've got one copy of the symmetry algebra for the whatever number of particles you've got. You have to figure out what that does on things like two-particle states. So how can you think of a tensor product? Because presumably our two-particle states can be thought of as in a tensor product space that describes the states of each of them. How do we think of that tensor product as a representation of our symmetry algebra? So we do have A tensor A, two copies of the algebra, and this is actually itself an algebra with the following product. So a basis element of A tensor A is something of the form A1 tensor A2. And if we have two of these, we can define the product, and we just multiply in components. So this is how we define the product structure on the tensor product. Similarly, we add. Well, if we want to add, we'll have to add the pairs. In the case of the algebra, we get to add the individual elements, not like entangled states. It's also defined pointwise. So this is an algebra. And it acts on our example space V1 tensor V2, product of two particles, simply by letting the first A act on V1, the second one acts on V2. So this would be fine if we wanted to have more symmetry in the system, basically, every time we add a particle. Because every time we add a particle, we've got another copy of some space V1 and we're getting a lot more symmetry coming in, really. That's not really what we have. What we really need is just one copy of our algebra, and the structure we need is called a coproduct. And so what we need is we need some action of the algebra A acting in this product. So we need to distribute the action of A between the members of this tensor product. So we're going to have a map, delta, which is a map from A into A tensor A, which can then act on these two vector spaces. And so in general, acting on an element of the algebra little a, this would be a linear combination of elements from A tensor A. We don't need any coefficients here because we can just absorb them into these elements, little a, A1, AI prime, and AI double prime. And now we're ready to let this act on V1 tensor V2. And what we do, in addition, is we, apart from this map being linear, we also require that it's algebra homomorphism, which means that applied to a product, is equal to the product of these maps, delta of A, delta of B, calculated in A tensor A.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
The delta A, the A only belongs to the big A, but on the other side you have AI prime, AI double prime. So I mean, expecting you have something only depend on the one A in the big A.
Well, this only depends on little a. Depending on what little a you plug in here, you get different things on the right-hand side. But there are a lot of terms here. But nonetheless, for any given little a, there's a unique, well, there's some expression. There may be different ways to write the same expression, of course. But,
so you'll say the ai prime is a function of little a?
Yeah, these depend on what we have for little a on the left-hand side.
That is not specified.
No.
Different
specifications will be different co-products. In practice, there's usually going to be one natural co-product that will satisfy all the conditions we need for a given situation.
That's because A is a natural thing to take.
No.
No. Well, not except in some special. Well, I'm going to give the examples in a second, so bear with me. Okay. So this is the algebra property. I was going to write this out, but I think I'll skip it. As I said, if I using this co-product now, I can let this element little a act on some basis state v1 tensor v2. And what I get is then sum on I, ai prime v1 tensor ai double prime v2. So now I've got something which is, again, some linear combination of elements in v1 tensor v2. And because this obeys this algebraic relation here, it's a homomorphism, this gives me an action of the algebra A on the tensor product space. Okay, so now I'm ready, in fact. Now I've actually logically defined a way in which I can analyze the tensor product space just into representations of the original algebra A. Okay, which perhaps I already know all of them. So just before I get to the example cases, one additional property we have here, which is quite important, is called co-associativity. Now, this is why I wrote associativity for the product in terms of diagrams. I can get the co-associativity of the co-product by taking the diagram that I drew over there for associativity and reversing all the arrows. Okay, so then maybe I'm rearranging a little bit. So if I just start with A at the top left, I can apply delta and get A tensor A. Then I can apply delta again, but I have a choice of whether to do it on the first A or the second A. And then I put an identity map in the other place. So here I'll write delta tensor the identity. Over here, I apply delta, and at the bottom, I'm going to apply the delta to the second A, and I finish up in A tensor A tensor A. And again, these iterated maps are required to commute. This diagram commutes, and that means that it tells me I have that. Translates into an equation at the level of elements, which we call co-associativity. It has to hold for all elements that we can apply this to. And why is this important? The point about co-associativity is that when this holds, it ensures that the product, the tensor product of three vector spaces is associative. So these co-algebra properties that I've now introduced translate over to nice properties of the tensor product. Okay, so this product of representations is associative, not only just in terms of the vector spaces, but even as representations of A. And that's important. It makes things look very nice, but we have to explicitly say that this is what we're assuming, this is what we're building in. What are the examples? So as I mentioned at the beginning, the finite groups and the Lie groups, Lie algebras, can be given these structures. So in the case of the algebra of a finite group, the coproduct is defined by just acting on the basis elements which correspond to elements of the group. Then delta of G is simply G tensor G. After all, that turns out to be very simple in this example. And then you can check that this obeys co-associativity. Okay. In the case of the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra such as SU2, now we have generators Ji. It's enough, because it's an algebra homomorphism, it's enough to define this on these generators. And this is just one tensor Ji plus Ji tensor 1. Okay, now this you should recognize from graduate quantum mechanics, because this is how you learn to add angular momentum in quantum mechanics. Okay, in fact, implicitly, you might have learned the same thing for finite groups at some point.
So this is a reformulation of J total equals J1 plus
J1. Exactly. Now, when you learn quantum mechanics, you probably take this as something that must be obvious, even though the instructor doesn't tell you why it has to be true. Okay. So this is how formally you can check that these things have to hold. So you really need the coproduct. You have to actually define this thing, otherwise you don't know how to add angular momenta. Okay. Now there's one other property that both of these have, which you might notice, which is that these examples are co-commutative, which means that if I flip the two factors in the tensor product, I get the same expression. Okay, so I can write that using the flip map, what I call delta op. The opposite coproduct is this flip operation applied after delta. That's the definition. Co-commutative means that these are, equal. Okay, so if I take the coproduct and I flip it, I get the same thing. That's called co-commutative. And so finite groups and Lie algebras give rise to co-commutative coproducts. All right, so now we're ready to define a Hopf algebra. So a Hopf algebra is an associative algebra with a co-associative coproduct. Doesn't have to be co-commutative. It's got all these, it's got various relations, including ones I haven't actually mentioned. It also has a couple of other things which I'm not really going to use in this talk, so I'm not really going to define them. It has a co-unit and an antipode. Co-units is the sort of dual, is the dual of idea of the unit element in the algebra 1. And the antipode is something whose definition uses both the product and the coproduct. And in cases like the finite group, it's related to the inverse existence of inverse elements for the group elements, which I haven't used up to this point. Both of these, as I said, these things beginning with co tend to have some meaning in terms of representations. The co-unit is used to define the one-dimensional representation whose tensor product with anything gives the same representation. And the antipode is used to define dual representations, representations such that if you take the tensor product with the original representation, you can find the trivial representation in the product. Okay, we're not really going to use those, so we'll forget those now. But implicitly they're there, they're part of the definition of a Hopf algebra. Okay, so often nearly an hour I've actually managed to define the subject of the talk. Okay, so what is this good for? Well, now we come back to, well, first of all, what it's good for is we now have much more structure. We can now analyze tensor products of representations. We can combine particles into multiplets, analyze them into their multiplets. So what happens now? Well, we come back to this co-commutativity. So these examples are co-commutative. Are there non-co-commutative Hopf algebras? Well, it turns out that there are. So these would, in some sense, generalize groups and Lie algebras. They certainly can't be equivalent to groups or Lie algebras because those would be co-commutative. it don't really want to be totally general here, partly for physical reasons, I think having to do with locality in physics in a quantum field theory. So the fruitful thing to do is to relax only a little bit the requirements. So we're just going to relax the co-commutativity a little bit. We're not going to just drop it completely. We're going to replace it by something slightly more general. Okay, so this is going to require a couple more definitions. So, we'll have an invertible element R, which is a member of A tensor A. So we'll take it, we'll have a Hopf algebra A, and an invertible element in A tensor A is called an R matrix, not very imaginatively, if it does the following. It's going to relate this opposite co-multiplication here, delta op. It's going to tell us how that's related to delta. So delta op applied to an element A, this would just be AI double prime tensor, AI prime in terms of my standard way of writing delta of A. Now I've flipped the order of the factors. And that's equal to delta of A conjugated by R. So it's R delta of A R inverse. Well, it's not quite a unitary transformation, but it's a little bit like saying that we've got something like that. So this is going to enable us to make some progress. We've got some relation between the opposite and the original co-multiplication involving a non-trivial matrix or operator. So that's the basic definition of the R matrix. And if it also obeys the following nasty-looking identities, it's called quasi-triangular. At some point, you may not want to write down all the definitions. Maybe this is that point. And a similar formula, id tensor delta applied to R is equal to R13R12. Then we say that the Hopf algebra A is quasi-triangular. Okay, so, yeah.
What is the difference between delta of A and delta op of A?
So delta op, this sigma, remember, is just the thing which reverses the order of the two things in the tensor product. Okay, and that's why this starts with AI double prime and follows with AI prime, which are different elements. Okay, so this looks very abstract, and I'll try to immediately interpret this in terms of representations, which is what we always want to do with these co-product structures. That's what they're for. First I have to define this notation I've used here. Things like R13 appear. So in this case, R is already an element of A tend to A, acting with delta, we're now living in A tend to A tend to A, and R, things like R1, 3, means that we, if R, let's see, if R is some element Ri prime, tensor Ri double prime, then this will, the case, the example R1, 3, we take Ri double prime, tensor 1, tensor Ri prime. Okay, so we're just letting these pieces of R, which was originally in A tensor A, act at particular places in the tensor product A tensor A tensor A, and by switching the order of 1 and 3, we've indicated that we're switching the positions of these, which would have been the other way around in the original R. Okay, so we have similar definitions for all these other things like R2, 3, and R1, 2, and so on. So it just tells you which ones they're acting on. Okay. So now for the explanation. So what we want to do is we want to relate the product, now I've switched to U and V, two representations, U and V, tensor product, to V tensor U. So we'll define sigma UV to be this flip map applied after R. So this is, and this is going to be applied in U tensor V. And sigma UV is an isomorphism mapping U tensor V to V tensor U. And now we can introduce the following suggestive diagram for this isomorphism. Okay. And of course, we all know that the arrow of time runs vertically. So we start at the bottom with U tensor V, and sigma UV takes these to V and U flipped at the top in a particular way, which we will keep track of the sense of. Okay. Well, that's just a picture. That's just something to help the visualization at this stage. But of course, the real meat is in the equations. And we've defined sigma UV. And now we can show, in fact, that these maps sigma UV obey the following identity. If we take a triple tensor product, we can apply this to pairs out of the three, and we'll just apply it to adjacent members in the sequence, and then we get a big hexagonal diagram. V tensor U tensor W, then we have V tensor W tensor U, then we have W tensor V tensor U, and over here we go to U tensor W tensor V. At the bottom we have W tensor U tensor V, and then we can map up to here. So that gives us all six orderings of U, V, and W. And each of these maps is something of the form of one of these sigmas. For example, this one, we leave U untouched, and then we apply sigma VW, because we're going from V tensor W to W tensor V. And the others are all similar. And this is, once again, required to commute. Okay. So what does this mean? Well, if we use the suggestive diagrams here, then starting from this place at the top left and going to the bottom right, what we've got, perhaps is no surprise, this is just going to be a braiding relation. So first we're going to flip the first two, then we exchange this one, then we exchange those. And this sequence of operations, this map, is equal to doing it the other way. Like that. Okay. And so this you can recognize as, so this is a generator in the grade group. Here we've got three objects. We can define the grade group on three objects by using these flips or these diagrams to define the flips. And they have to obey this relation, which just suggests that you can deform these lines without anything crossing. As long as nothing crosses, you can define the lines, deform the lines. So that's the meaning of this at the level of representations, and these formulas here are used in deriving this identity using the definitions. In fact, we can interpret this one of these relations at the bottom here. If we imagine that we take two of our strands and we view them as a unit, just as one thing, I'll shade it to indicate that it's one thing, we would like to exchange those. And what we're saying is that exchanging those is just equivalent to first exchanging with the first one and then with the next one. Like that. So that's the meaning of this equation right here. Okay. And I want to mention that one other thing which I found helpful, that the fact that this is an isomorphism implies in particular that it means that the action of the flip commutes with the operations in the algebra, which of course have to be applied using the coproduct. So you apply the coproduct, apply an algebra element before or after the flip, it makes no difference. And that's the key property here. So sigma commutes with the action of the algebra on this thing. Okay.
So I understand that if R equal to identity, then it's a subset of all the conditions. If R is identity. And then, but those conditions may give you extra non-trivial solutions, which you represent.
Sure where you're heading. So you might have a non-trivial R. That's correct.
So those conditions essentially is a condition on the R.
So these are the basic conditions here. That's a consequence of these, actually. I think these that may not be logically equivalent, but anyway, these.
Those are conditions which allow you to determine R.
Yeah. These are constraints on finding R. Yeah. Okay. So now we're really starting to see braiding coming into this, as we probably were expecting all along. And this is really a key relationship. It means that the braiding operations commute with the action of the algebra A. And so we've got an action of the braid group that commutes with the action of A.
That is a consequence of the condition below there?
Yes. So once you have these conditions, then all this follows. Okay. So in particular, suppose that we choose all of these representations to be isomorphic. Suppose we have some representation V, and we take products like this. So now we can just permute these, braid these, and now we're really getting something that looks like particle statistics. Now we're really close to what we want to do with identical, indistinguishable particles. In the co-commutative case, this would just boil down to permutations. That is, in the co-commutative case, R is trivial, and we have an additional, we have additional relations that tell us that when you braid twice, you get the identity operation. Okay. All right, maybe I should field some more questions.
So this difference between two-dimensional and three-dimensional, and that's, in this case, if you compute twice, you have to get identity, that's the
Well,
three-dimensional.
Yeah, well, when you start talking about three dimensions like that, what you're really doing is you want to assume that you're in something like quantum field theory with locality built in. And then that leads to some natural requirements, which are only solved if you have just the permutation group and no non-trivial braiding. Basically because, you know, you can deform the lines around each other. They're not even topologically distinct anymore. Okay. All right, so I've defined all this structure, and I ought to give you an example now. So a lot of this that I've been telling you comes from Drinfeldt, particularly. These were defined by Drinfeldt and independently by Jimbo. So we can deform, it's possible to deform the universal enveloping algebra of some Lie algebra into a non-co-commutative Hopf algebra, which we'll call UQ of G. And Q is a parameter. The Q goes to one limit of UQ of G is just the original co-commutative algebra U of G. Okay, so for any value of Q, we've got such an algebra. In particular, we could talk about UQ of SL2. So now what I should do is I should write down the definitions of the product, the coproduct, the unit, co-unit, antipode, and R matrix. But I'm not going to do that. So they're big and complicated and messy, and they won't tell you very much. You might have seen them before somewhere, but it will be more useful. Not only do you have to write them down, but really you're supposed to check all of these relations I've told you. It would be more useful to, again, pass over to talking about how the representations behave. So we'll talk about representations of this algebra. It includes the possibility of tensor products of them. Okay, so anyway, this is a quasi-triangular Hopf algebra. It really does have all these things, including the R matrix. So what do its representations look like? Well, in fact, in the generic case, they look a lot like representations of SU2 or SL2. So for the case where Q is not a root of unity, we have to start saying things like that. So if Q is not equal to 1 for any non-zero power of Q, this is the generic case. Special things happen if Q to some power is equal to 1 or minus 1. In the generic case, what happens is that there are finite dimensional irreducible representations of spin for each spin in the usual set 0, half, 1, and so on. And the dimensions of these representations are 2s plus 1. This is perhaps not terribly surprising given that we can continuously change this parameter q. So with a bit of luck, things will change continuously. And
is the general feature that the dimension would depend on Q?
As long as you're at generic Q, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so a lot of the structure will be the same for the generic Q cases. And indeed, it's still semi-simple. The finite dimensional representations decompose into direct products. And the fusion, what we call the fusion rules, which I'll now define, these are rules for the analysis of the tensor products. So let's say that V lambda, for whatever set of lambdas we've got, so these are the spins here, but it could be any, whatever set labels the irreducibles, the highest weight vectors, if you like. So then we'd like to know how products of irreducibles decompose, and they're going to decompose into some sum of irreducibles. In general, there might be multiplicities here, as we mentioned the other day, but okay, so we can decompose into some copies of irreducibles, and we might have more than one, in which case the notation is that this factor n, which is just an integer, plus a non-negative integer, means that if n is bigger than 1, we just take a direct sum of more than one copy of the representation. Okay. So those are known as the fusion rules. These numbers, n, lambda, mu, nu, for general cases, are important data to understand. And for the spinner half case, for the SL2 case, in fact, for any of these algebras, these are the same as in the undeformed algebra. So these numbers, or these rules, are in fact the same. Okay, it still sounds like SL2. The difference is that you really do have a non-trivial R matrix. So when you try to flip things, you do get some non-trivial grading.
Yeah.
All right.
An hour and 15 minutes, so I think you don't need to wrap up. Because
no, okay.
You can go on as long as you want.
Until I lock the building. All right. So I will very quickly tell you what I will do, and then I will do it.
And then after he tells us very quickly what he will do, those of you who are not interested in seeing him do it can leave. We'll clap.
Okay. All right, that's fine. So next, what I'm going to do is I'm going to discuss the very interesting application to the spinner half chain, where spinner half means under UQSL2.
How about taking like a 5-minute break?
We can do that.
Sessions.
Yeah.
Okay,
so I'll tell you what I'm going to do before we take the break. So
sure,
going to look at this chain, and in fact, the XXZ spin chain basically possesses UQSL2 symmetry. Okay, and so we'll look at that to analyze the chain. We'll analyze the chain into representations of UQSL2, and we also have the flip operators or braiding operations, which also act on the states of the chain. So the representation theory of the braid group comes in to analyzing these states. The Temple-Lieb algebra crops up there. We'll mention that. And then I will finally make contact with non-abelian statistics in things like SU2, level K, Chern-Simons, and exactly soluble one-dimensional models, knot theory, Karaha numbers.
Those will
just be mentioned.
Right,
at that stage, in much less detail.
So let me make a suggestion that we'll meet back here at 5. And we'll temporarily thank Nick for introducing it. And those of you who don't want to come back don't have to. And those who want to learn will come back, OK? So we'll be back right here in 10 seconds.
I'm thinking tomorrow of talking about Temple-Lieb algebra and the Bra number, so that comes in, just in case that influences you either positively or negatively.
Yeah.
I'd take the opportunity to ask a slightly technical question.
Okay.
You passed over the issue of the antipode.
Yes.
Which actually was something that I used to do, and it came back quite.
Yes.
So all this stuff with the braiding and the Yang-Baxter structure,
and that doesn't, without the antipode, it's not the Hochfeld, it's not a Hochfeld.
Right, it's a bialgebra now, exactly. That's what they call it now.
And I spent a bit of time trying to understand the finite length Hubbard chain. To look for its quote quantum group without possibly understanding, having swept the whole business of the existence of the antipode under the carpet as one of those little extra details, which didn't seem quite important.
I'm sure there's a lot of stuff where you don't really need it.
However, the antipode, I think it was what guaranteed the existence of a quantum determinant and all this other kind of stuff. And I said, and without the antipode, I found you're actually screwed.
Yeah.
So.
Is there a technical definition of screwed?
I'm not sure, but it's not got it. So it's not a hot.
No, so it doesn't have all the nice properties, suddenly.
So
yeah.
A lot of the nice properties of these things are in without the Hopf condition, just the everything else except the antipode. Like the Young-Baxter in general doesn't have an antipode to go for it.
In fact, years ago, I think Hopf algebra was defined without the antipode, and lately everyone's decided the best definition is with the antipode as part of the definition. But that's terminology, anyway.
Quasi-Fraenkel, I think, meant the antipode of the
alternative. No, I don't think so.
So without a quantum group has to have an antipode.
Okay.
And
all right. Different authors seem to say different things. So I mean, Charlie and Presley, never quite give a formal definition of quantum group, but they basically say that it's a Hopf algebra, including the antipode.
Yeah, because you can't find a whole lot of this good stuff without the antipode.
Yeah.
And I hadn't appreciated that until because it seemed like a kind of little kind of obscure extra detail buried where you buried it.
So are you saying that the representation theory breaks down? I mean, it's not nice anymore. You lose all kinds of nice properties,
unfortunately, the
representations
The irreducible. It was a crucial point somehow that the formal, for example, on the these matrix representations, right? You had to have something like, because the inverse of a matrix is the cofactor divided by the determinant.
Oh, and then you lose the determinant.
You needed to have an object like the determinant, the quantum determinant, commuted with every Gradham element of the group. And it was the antipode property that guarantees that. Mm-hmm. It turns out for the Hubbard model, I was wondering what, take a finite size Hubbard model, you build it up, what the hell is the quantum group of the Hubbard model, right? Mm-hmm. And the Dan situation, not a quantum group. The Hubbard model only obtains a quantum group structure in the thermodynamics, quite unlike the Heisenberg chain, which has a whole antipode structure and the quantum group structure building it up side by side. The Hubbard model, it turns out, does not have it until you take the thermodynamic limit. Then in a magic case of the thermodynamic limit algebra, you can get an infinite length Hubbard model. You can kind of decomposes and you get the two Yangians and stuff like that. But you don't have, but you know, we spent quite a bit of time looking at that, assuming there had to be some, had to correspond to some quantum group like structure, maybe Clifford algebras or God knows what. And it's not meant.
I suppose this is all connected with all these difficulties of understanding the. I mean, it's always been difficult to understand the Hubbard model in the standard language of integrable systems.
That's the whole issue of the Hubbard. Why it's it doesn't have the proper difference property of the as a function of the spectral parameter of the finite system. It turns out in the thermodynamic limit it does, and that's related to that. And it's actually reading this formal definition of Carey and Presley. Oh, by the way, there's property antipode.
Yeah. No, they don't do it to the extent that I did.
No, but they sort of don't quite motivate it.
So it has to do with the dual. But you mentioned quantum determinant. But if you also look at quantum trace or quantum dimensions, there's stuff in there which uses it. You have to define an element U and an element V,
and the point was that uses the antipode. All this other stuff and the R matrix and all that stuff, because it's present for any Young-Baxter system, and it was somehow.
They couldn't use it.
It was not at all obvious that this little kind of extra piece, the existence of the antipode, was actually very fundamental. Because it implied this so called quantum determinant property on defined a thing that can use the other thing. It's kind of like something like the existence of a Casimir operator for the.
No, that's right. It's related
to. Is it pronounced I never know if it is antipode or antipode.
Oh, I don't know. That's antipodean. When you turn it into an adjective, it becomes antipodal or antipodean.
Because Australia and New Zealand are the antipodes.
I suppose if I was really doing Greek pronunciation, it should be antipode.
So I suspect it's probably antipode.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I've ever heard anyone say antipode. So. But British people are well known for mangling foreign words, so I think I'll probably be forgiven. No one's embarrassed me by telling me the correct pronunciation yet, except until now, anyway. Fermi, yeah, Piers, yes. My Fermi. Pauling. Yeah, my favorite example was I was at some semiconductor conference and I'm sitting there, we're talking about 2D electron gas, and some guy in the audience asked a question about the Wiener crystal. Wigner, well, it's very logical, it should be Wiener.
People say white money, big money.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I heard this.
So where do you think it comes in? So it's actually somehow... Out of that little episode, I realized
yes.
One thing was crucial.
Oh, yeah. It's important
because
for...
Because just a young Baxter structure, which has no notion of the antipode yet.
But I don't...
It's just a bi-algebra.
It's not so bi-algebra,
but it's got co-products and co-commutators.
Yeah. I don't think I've been dishonest, Duncan. I really haven't used it so far.
No, I know.
I really haven't used it.
That's why you can get by with all this stuff. I thought it was a little kind of...
But when you get to quantum determinants, I have no idea. You may, I don't know. But certainly for the quantum trace, which is how you define Q dimension, you use it. You even need something else. You need to be able to take the square root. And at that point, you are using... central elements. So in that sense, it's like a Casimir.
Yeah.
Something's like a Casimir.
So, I mean, as I say, I didn't really realize its importance until we spent quite a bit of time worrying all. Here's this kind of nice Hubbard model. It's got a R form, TT prime equals R, T prime T, and all that good stuff. And suddenly, it's a quantum group, right? And no, it's not a quantum group.
So that's the reason why the Anderson model doesn't work. Because
the Anderson model does work.
I haven't published it. You talked about this three years ago.
That's right.
It works for the Anderson model.
The Anderson model has a Yangian.
It has a Yangian.
And you managed to check all the identities for the Yangian?
No. Ah. That's true. I guess.
It's the SU2 Yangian, is it?
I found the Yangian, but we found the thing that commutes with the damn thing.
Yeah.
I guess there was still, what happened, we never kind of found...
Doesn't it use the same as the Hubbard? It's a representation which is similar to the Hubbard one, isn't it? If I remember correctly, at least the beta answer is similar.
Actually, if you look at the general property, I've got to somehow do something with it. I've got this kind of unfinished, I didn't actually get... There was a whole lot of unfinished stuff with that. Where the Hubbard stuff came from that, but what to do with it, I don't know. But it's not guessable. It turns out that the guess Dublin Corrigan or guessed Dubkov, I guess, guessed the made an appropriate guess of the Yangian of the Hubbard model based on. It locks out. In the sense that generically, when you look at the generic structure for it, there's actually another piece that generally enters and happens to vanish identically with respect to the nearest neighbor Hubbard model. But actually, if you take the long range Hubbard model, it's one over sine inch business. It's got the same structure as in the Anderson model. So it's a nice little piece that you wouldn't guess out of this use. So the Anderson model one isn't quite guessable by kind of I should do something with that.
Well, there's a result, I think, it's very interesting. The problem is how to regularize it The other thing we try to get is some of the constant motion that I have in mind.
So, is this the audience now?
SLE. You're doing SLE?
He wandered off and there's no longer my
student. Who's doing that? So, Eisenlander.
I'm
not
sure he's doing it myself.
So
you have any insight into why we need to put in this up? Can you explain the importance of the antipode? Or the antipode?
The antipode?
Yeah.
Oh. What you do is, if this is a matrix associated to an element G, then you write down the matrix associated to G inverse.
Yeah.
Transpose.
Right.
This is how you go from representation to its dual ordinarily.
Mm-hmm.
And. This is the occurrence of the antipode in the group-like elements in the universal Abelian algebra. So you need some generalization of G inverse, basically.
Right.
So a lot of this stuff doesn't. Yeah, as I said, this experience of looking at the Hubbard model on with finite size.
Yeah.
And of course, it's got all the good Yang backs that
it needs. Yeah, it doesn't have an angle.
What does that mean? That you can't study the expectations of the Hubbard model?
Well, the problem is the Hubbard model.
Upgrade. Which model?
The really complicated ones are back. The really complicated ones or really close friends of me.
All right, I only have 3 pages left.
No, that's enough. But you have to give examples. So I have to go.
Right, I have an example. And let me have some. Right, so then.
Okay, Duncan, let's start. Right. So we have now Nick Reed part 2, the real fun stuff. I mean, the first stuff was good.
Did they tape us chatting during the interval?
I always don't know
when.
It
doesn't get the audience. It'll just be you talking to yourself.
Actually, that's what
this is.
It's a system, right?
All right. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to... is a very natural example which is instructive, and then I will get even more sketchy and make connections to one or two other things to show you how, illustrate how a few interesting things are connected to each other. So this is an application or an example. So we're going to take an open spin chain without a periodic boundary condition. Also, for lack of time, I'm not going to be terribly explicit with lack of time to prepare, that is, with things like numerical coefficients and explicit formulas. But, okay. So a natural thing to look at, since we want to talk about especially the braiding operations on on some iterated tensor product. So let's just take UQSL2 and take the spinner half representation and have n copies of it tensored together. And so now the rather amazing fact is that the So it's the usual nearest neighbor. Nearest neighbor XY XXZ Hamiltonian, but with some boundary term. So there's some funny effect at the boundary. And this actually is invariant under UQSL2. Now, some people here probably know very well exactly what those terms look like, but I can't remember and didn't have time to look them up.
Q minus Q inverse.
Yeah, sigma
it's,
z.
It's Q minus Q inverse, yeah. And then the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's boundary magnetic field times Q minus Q inverse, and then the Q inverse minus Q, which is actually imaginary. So it's an imaginary boundary magnetic field.
Well, that depends on whether Q is.
Sorry, Q
isn't
really unit.
Well,
sorry,
I'm not.
Hamiltonian is. I mean, the Hilbert space is just.
It's just tensor product of spinner halves, so okay. Qubits. So, in fact. Hello? So, in fact, I claim that Hamiltonian is basically the flip operators, since they're not self-inverse, I'm going to add in sigma inverse as well. I claim, hopefully no one's going to correct me, but I claim that this actually is the Hamiltonian.
But these sigmas are not the Pauli matrices.
No, these are the flip operators.
Okay.
I was calling them sigma UV.
Okay.
Now I mean sigma acting on these neighboring sites.
The same as the exchange operator?
Yeah, the exchange operator. Yeah, let's call it the exchange operator. Which depend on Q, right. So this is sigma V1 half, V1 half, but I'm telling you which sites.
Okay. You can write those out explicitly?
I'm not going to write them out explicitly. But you see,
it's a permutation matrix with Qs.
Yeah, except that it's representing braid group, not permutation group.
Right.
Okay. Now you see, if I write the Hamiltonian down like this, then we know immediately that it commutes with UQSL2, because I told you that over here, right? So that's it.
What are the issues to do with the non-Hermitian? I guess it's...
Well, this will be Hermitian if Q is real.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm confused. It's a very dumb question. Where is Q entering explicitly here? Is that because you didn't write the extended
operator? It's buried in the form of these.
It's buried in there, right?
So these are 4x4 matrices because they act in.
Which depend on.
Yeah.
And they are known, you're just not writing.
And they don't. And they certainly don't look invariant under ordinary SU2. Okay. But this Hamilton, it's an XXZ type of chain. It's not. Does not look SU2 invariant. But it is UQSL2 invariant.
Oh, right, and at the Q equals 1 case, it's just
it becomes the spinner half chain.
Spinner half, which is just written as a permutation.
Right, so permutation, that's right. So the SI dot SJ is a permutation operator, up to some addition of the identity.
Right.
Okay.
So you're saying that the system is UQ invariant for all generic dots in Q?
If I define this to be the Hamiltonian constructed out of UQSL2 here with this nice property, this by construction commutes with UQSL2.
I'm sorry, where's the coproduct? I mean, delta's the coproduct, but where is it on the other side of the five-fourth?
I have to use the coproduct to commute H with UQSL2, right? So what I'm saying, in other words, to be completely explicit, what I'm saying is that H times delta of A, which I've really got to iterate this many times to get it to act on N, so that I have N, I need a map into A tensor to the N. that commutes with this Hamiltonian H.
You have a global SU2 symmetry, right?
I have a global UQ SL2 symmetry.
So is it the XXX or the XXZ?
XXZ.
It's what happens when you deform.
But exchange operator sigma under sigma and XXX.
No,
yeah, but it's no longer simply the exchange operator. Okay, so it's not. It's a non-trivial matrix.
It's still got Qs in there. That still
is this 4x4 matrix which depends
yeah.
on Q.
But if the Q yeah. equals 1, you'll get a bit of signal
right.
exchange.
If Q equals 1, it's basically the exchange.
Just exchange.
If Q is not equal to 1, it's more complicated, and it's basically the XXZ Hamiltonian.
But it's no.
It's known. You can work it out.
I'm just not writing it down.
I'm not writing it down. You can work it out. You can write it in different bases.
We can just work it out.
And look it up.
XXZ parameter delta related to Q.
Yes. So delta is something like Q plus Q inverse. Suitably normalized.
Known function of Q.
Q plus Q inverse. Right.
Yeah. So Q is yeah. this sort of critical region
in Q and the author. Oh, you asked generic. Okay, so Mike's question was whether this is true for generic Q.
Well, also, where are you using the fact that it's J1?
I think, well, it may be that I have to say that XXZ is just for the real Q case or something like that.
But my, it's only XXZ.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, one at a time, folks.
So that's X, Y, Z all of this algebra, or just a sort of different more complex?
No, I don't know. It's some god awful.
Yeah,
know.
It's much worse. Right? That's
one and that, I know.
Yeah.
That's one
to continue. All right. Okay. So I told you at the beginning, the Hopf algebra stuff is really for defining global symmetries of things, and that's what we've managed to get here. In fact, it's global. It even acts in a reasonably nice way on these things.
So what do you learn about this chain from this observation?
Well, you could classify the spectrum using it, right? You can. In fact, I'm going to say this some of this now. Well, So what this means is that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian has degeneracies which are UQSL2 multiplets. Those, for the generic case at least, those aren't very exciting because they're just of the form 2s plus 1. But that's just like the ordinary SU2 invariant spin chain. Now it is crucial here that we have these boundary terms. If you just write the XXZ model without the boundary terms, it doesn't have the symmetry. When you construct it out of this, so what happens is you get terms appearing here, and some of them cancel between I plus 1 and I plus 1, I plus 2. And then something fails to cancel on the end, and these boundary terms are left over. Okay, and that's when it looks like, in the interior of the chain, it looks like the XXE Hamiltonian, but at the end there's an extra term. And the extra term is crucial in making it commute with the UQSL2 and having this degeneracy. Okay.
In other applications, you can get all the RSOS models if you project onto states that are singlets under UQSL2.
Yeah.
Height models.
I was going to say something about that in a while. So I should also mention that this stuff like this is basically how these quantized universal enveloping algebras were discovered in the first place. They basically arose out of work on these integrable systems and were abstracted from work on integrable systems from the stuff like the inverse scattering method and algebraic beta ansatz.
As Q approaches 1,
yeah.
The Hamiltonian approaches 0.
No, it approaches the isotropic
permutation
operator. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. In that limit, the sigmas become the generators of the permutation group. Okay. All right, so the states, all the states can be decomposed into multiplets of spin 2s plus 1. Let's actually forget about the Hamiltonian and just decompose the whole space. Yeah.
What actually happens to the stuff at the end?
the stuff at the ends disappears.
So you see, oh, okay, yeah, because this thing is only classical by like, global view of UQ.
Right,
so
it's yes.
It's not like the whole Shastri thing where you've got the kind of whole quantum groups.
Right.
So, yeah,
the whole quantum. I'm not sure what you mean by the
global,
whole.
Global,
you mean some Yangian or something? Well, this is a quantum group, but you mean a Yangian or something?
Yeah.
Let's stop the side discussions. We can continue with that after.
All right. All right. So I want to just let's just go back to the. To the XXX chain, or the, in other words, the SU2 invariant chain for a minute, and just look at that. And so this is sort of classical stuff. So it's just global, ordinary, old-fashioned SU2. And what happens is you get spins, obviously, from zero. I'm going to take n even. It spins up to n over 2. And the multiplicities, so what happens here is that we now have the permutation group or symmetric group Sn acts on the spin chain or is a symmetry of the chain. Okay. So this is generated by the sigmas. I'm sorry, let me actually make a correct statement. This commutes with the global symmetry algebra. Commutes with SU2. Okay, so this is just generated by these operators that just exchange the neighboring spins in the ordinary SU2 chain. So now we've got two commuting algebras, and that means that we can decompose the space of states into representations of one tensored with corresponding representations of the other. So that takes the following form. We can label these by the total spin. We've got these representations for SU2 of spin S here in dimension 2S plus 1. But we can also then we have each of these occurs with some multiplicity. There's many, in general, there's many states of each total spin.
I'm confused. How have we only had the translational group? So how, why is it?
Because I don't know. All right, we're going to go back a second. So
you're talking about the Hamiltonian.
I've got this chain, and I'm not even looking at the Hamiltonian anymore. Okay. I'm just looking at the SU2 global symmetry operations, and I've got these. And some algebra, which happens to be the permutation group, is generated by the flips of nearest neighbors, which commutes with the UQ with USL2. Okay, that's the crucial equation which I used to have in this box, which I've now erased.
Right, but permutation group, you can flip any two.
You can flip any two using those operations. That's correct. And that implies, and because that commutes with U of SL2. That implies that the states in the chain fall into representations of the permutation group at the same time as they fall into representations of SU2. So they can be classified into representations of the direct product of these algebras or into tensor products of representations of these commuting algebras. So what we've got here is a space of dimension 2s plus 1 with a multiplicity, which is a dimension of a representation of the permutation group. This is the multiplicity of the states of each spin. Okay. In mathematics, this is called Frobenius-Schur duality, or Weyl also. Hermann Weyl got into this. This is the reason that we can label SU2 or SUN representations by Young tableaus. Okay. So the Young tableau for this is a tableau. And this has total of n boxes. They always have a total of n boxes. This has n plus 2s over 2 in the first row and n minus 2s over 2 boxes in the second row. So this is a representation of Sn. And we don't get all the possible different representations of Sn, we only get the ones with at most two rows, because we're only doing SU2. Okay, and this accounts for all the states of the chain. These commute in some maximal sense, and so this gives you all of the states in the chain without any additional multiplicities. Okay. And
so,
yeah.
So the label of states of, it's looking at the eigenstates of S total.
Right. So you take those and you can, and each of those, transform under the permutation group, and that accounts for the degeneracy.
Yeah, without any notion of the Hamiltonian.
Nothing. Hamiltonian doesn't. Now, as a matter of fact, the Hamiltonian is an element in the group algebra of the permutation group, because it's composed out of some permutations. I could have made it more general; it would still be such an object. Okay, so this is for the classical SU2 chain. Now this generalizes to the UQSL2 invariant chain.
Just before you leave the
classical
chain.
Mm-hmm. I mean classical. Well, even classic. Yeah. Classic. Come call
me Right. You mean like classic Coke?
So for a microdimension corresponds to the lowest eigenvalue.
Well, that depends on a Hamiltonian.
Well, I thought we were talking about X, Y, Z.
Okay, so then it depends on the sign, and I didn't worry about the sign here. So what we call the ferromagnetic chain is the case where the maximum spin is the lowest. Antiferromagnetic means that the minimum spin is the lowest, namely zero.
But that's what you might even mean by that. By the symmetry, that's determined by
the Hamiltonian.
The sign of the exchange constant.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So this is another bit of some classic analysis, which we'll now generalize to the quantum case. And for generic Q, in fact, it looks very much the same. We just change the names of the algebras. Of course, the braiding is non-trivial, but the dimensions, in particular, the dimensions of representations, will be the same. Okay, so in the quantized case, quantum deformed case, roughly speaking, the role of Sn is now taken, or C of Sn, the group algebra, is taken by the Temporally-Lieb algebra. That's a slight simplification. I'm wondering if I should confess to that or not. all right. And so what happens is that now we get an identical looking decomposition of, so this algebra, which we'll call TLN of Q. It's an algebra that depends on the parameter Q. And what happens is it's related to these operations, sigma I plus 1, which are now the non-trivial ones for the braid group that commutes with UQSL2. And these are basically, and my formula is probably wrong because I changed notation somewhere, but these are related to the TIs that I'm going to use in a moment, by multiplication by a constant and addition of a constant. Okay, so these splits are related to these TIs, and the Temporally-Lieb algebra is usually conveniently defined using these TIs. So we have I, these are the generators of the algebra. This runs from 1 to n minus 1. And the TIs obey the following set of relations, TI squared, and this is the first place where I've really used a Q that I need to normalize anything. TI plus or minus 1 long as that exists, is equal to Ti, I think. And Ti and Tj commute if mod of I minus j is bigger than 1. So these are related to flips on pairs of neighboring sites, and if they don't overlap, then they will commute. Okay. And this has representations. Well, then we go into these things. Then we can make use of these relations.
Shouldn't that have two more letters in it?
No. What happens is that the sigmas had 3 on one side and 3 on the other. That's the braid relation that we had for the braid group. When you do this shift and you with the appropriate form and multiply it out, well, actually what you get is you get an identity with two sides. And then this is the part that I was not telling you before, is that you get some expression and you decide that you're going to put both sides of the equation equal to 0 separately, which means what you're actually doing is taking the braid group and imposing an additional relation on the algebra. So strictly speaking, this is more like a quotient of this algebra by an ideal. That's the part I skipped over before. And the effect of that is that the irreducible representations are, or generic Q at least, are labeled exactly by the same set of Young tableaus with two rows. Whereas the permutation group, or the permutation group is labeled by the full set of Young tableaus of arbitrary shapes. Okay. But you see, in the spinner half chain, you only ever see these. And so we might as well just use the algebra where those are the only things you get.
Oh, I'm sorry, what class do you reduce to two low tableaus? The fact that it was SU2?
Because it's SU2, yes. That's
Did you have another way of seeing that?
I can't think right now. Maybe we can postpone that question for later. All right. But the basic point is that the Templer-Leib algebra is closely connected with this UQSL2 invariant chain. And in fact, this is an algebra that commutes with the UQSL2 in the chain. And the representations then allow us to describe the multiplicities of SU2 representations in the same way that we had here. So this is where this famous Templer-Leib algebra occurs. And Templer and Leib basically constructed this chain as a different representation of this algebra. They got this algebra from the Potts model, and they constructed a different representation of the same algebra in a different space, which was this one. Of course, they didn't know anything about UQSL2 when they did that.
So that's
another kind of integrable model connection.
But you say this degeneracy is remain the same, do not depend on Q.
So for generic, again, the same idea of generic Q, the dimensions of Templer-Leib representations are the same as these representations of SN.
So what depends on Q?
The algebra itself depends on Q here.
I see.
Right?
So correlation function.
Well, Q is already unity, that statement doesn't apply, right? The last one you made.
Well, when Q is a root of unity, the algebra is no longer semi-simple.
Okay.
And you can divide out by some further ideals.
Those are the exceptional cases when you wrote down.
Yeah.
Q to the power L.
Right.
One.
That's right.
Generic cases, Q to the power L not equal to 1.
Right.
So when Q is equal to 1, there's special kind of special kind.
Right. When Q is a root of unity. Right. Yeah. That's
so
right.
All these statements then need to be refined, or do they need to? Or they still apply, but have more things apply, or are they actually not quite whole?
Well, I haven't yet mastered the full representation theory of the Templer-Leib algebra at roots of unity, to be perfectly honest. But what you can do is you can truncate to a set of unitary representations, And this is what gives you the restricted solid on solid models,
right,
among other things.
And they really go through each other. Like if you tune Q through a special point where some levels become degenerate and go into a reducible representation or something, do they kind of, if 2S1 plus 1 plus 2S2 plus 1 come in on one side is the same S1 and S2 that you leave after you tune Q to that point, or do they kind of
I have no idea, Duncan. I don't know. Once you're off the root of unity, you're certainly back to the same representation theory.
But I think that there isn't really this co-dimension one phenomenon because you're really in the complex plane. So there's co-dimension two roots of unity where there's
So so what happens here is that because of this definition with whatever are the correct coefficients, the sigmas, remember, the sigmas generate, at the abstract level anyway, generate the braid group on n strands. And so by letting this act by this definition in a representation of Tempele-Lieb, this gives us representations of the braid group on n objects. Okay, and then we get the root of unity complications, which I might, well, I'll, so at this point I'm just going to say a few words about these without going into the real mathematics. Okay, so what happens at the, is there a question? I think we want to choose, say QDL is minus one. So what happens here in UQSL2? Well, what happens is that the representations contained in this product are not fully reducible. But for spins from 0, half up to k over 2, where k is equal to L plus 2 modulo some conventions that I probably aren't getting straight. These are still irreducible. That is to say that the modules VS are still irreducible UQ SL2 representations. And it's further possible to define a truncated product under which, shall call tensor with a bar over it. And for this new product, the fusion rules say that we get a direct sum of the same type of representations without multiplicities, and the spins on the right-hand side run from the usual lower limit up to an upper limit, which is the smaller of S1 plus S2 and K, I think this is right, K minus S1 minus S2. So they basically get reflected from the S equals, across the S equals K over 2 value. I hope I got the formula right.
So as long as you don't start with a funny representation, you won't generate them?
Well, you do generate them, but what we've done is they're sort of null vectors, and you can set them to zero consistently.
These cyclic representations.
Well, these are not cyclic representations. Well, in fact, I have to actually, another thing I've glossed over is you have to use the correct form of UQSL2 at a root of unity, which I forgot to even put in my notes. Well, that's a further complication. With the correct form of it, you don't get the cyclic representations, but anyway. So there's just a few words here. So then you get some kind of product like this. Now, this is, strictly speaking, no longer really a tensor product because the dimensions no longer match, as you can check with examples. The product of dimensions on the left-hand side is not equal to the sum of dimensions on the right-hand side because we've thrown stuff away. But we can, in some sense, which I don't really want to define, I suppose, we can still think of these as fusion rules for some kind of product of representations.
Could you explain the transition between the temporal eval algebra and SO, or UQ, SO2?
The relation between those?
Yeah, what's...
They commute in this same spin chain. Right, you have commuting actions. Yeah.
The temporally lead generators, can you construct the generators of UQSL2 or vice versa?
No, they commute with each other.
Okay.
So they're completely independent. They commute with each other.
Do you know what it's like, the spectrum of the chain with two or three sites is like as a function of Q? Presumably all in Pasquier and Soler.
Yeah. Well, look, at this point, you know, Pasquier and Soler embarked on the beginning of this. And then there's a few bells and whistles later, but they had most of it.
But can you remember what it looks like? Just the certain levels that go through each other?
No, I'm more concerned with the representation theory than with the solving a Hamiltonian. This has nothing to do with a particular Hamiltonian.
Yeah. But it's always kind of neutral.
Yeah, all right. All right.
Isn't there some, I'm a little confused by the fact that they're commuting, but on the other hand, it seems that there's very close similarity between the representations of the corresponding temporary lead algebras in SL3Q. That is, if you tune that Q correctly, then the representations of the temporary lead category actually will be an irreducible representation. One for each spin up to the same truncation that you have for the weird unity. So, I mean, it looks like there's a bijection between the representation of the temporal lead category and this sort of nice part of the representations.
There are more irreducible representations than just this. There are more irreducible representations. But when you decompose this product, you get some of these, but you also get some indecomposable, reducible but indecomposable representations, which have a certain structure, and they contain a submodule. They actually contain submodules. They contain submodules isomorphic to the Weyl modules of dimension 2s plus 1. And of course, there are irreducible quotient modules of various sizes. Are you saying all the irreducibles are isomorphic to these? I can't remember if that's true or not.
I'm not sure, but
yeah.
I'm wondering, is there a radical that you can divide out by UQ that would give you a very simple representation theory, everything is semi-simple?
That is what McCoy did. That's what McCoy does in these papers on additional symmetries of XXC
Because that's basically the story on the temporary leap side, is that two root of unity, then there's a radical, and you can divide out by that radical, and then you get a very simple.
I think that's exactly what this Fabricius and McCoy, this series of papers, I think that's what they're doing.
So then you get a semi-simple associative algebra, but I don't know if you have any nice product structure left after that.
Do you mean that if we take the quotient with respect to this radical, we don't get a finite-dimensional Hopf algebra?
I don't know what you get. So I don't know if it's a finite dimension. I would like it to be a finite-dimensional Hopf algebra. We're talking about UQSL2, right? I don't know. All right, so I'm going to try to finish my last bit here.
Sorry, are there non-commutative finite-dimensional Hopf algebras?
Yes.
Because the universe enveloping one and its deformations aren't.
Well, they're not finite-dimensional.
Yeah, but there are.
There are. There's an example by Swedler, which is quoted in all the books. It's four-dimensional. There were very few known before the quantized universal enveloping algebra. I don't know what they mean by very few, but not very many. Okay, so these are some fusion rules. Here are some fusion rules for this finite set of representations. And then I want to point out that these are the same fusion rules as in SU2 level K Wessumino-Witten conformal field theory, or SU2 level K Chern-Simons theory. So people that know what those are already know these facts. But at the same time, So that's a statement about these fusion rules for these UQSL2 representations. Now, if we take the so once we restrict to this space, we also get a representation of Temporally-Lieb, or actually Temporally-Lieb modulo yet another ideal. Which are the ones that Michael Friedman is usually referring to, right? Which depend on K. So for each K, you can divide by some ideal, and this is what's describing the non-abelian grading or statistics properties in these conformal field theories or Chern-Simons theories, or equally well in our series of parafermion quantum non-abelian quantum Hall states. And what else do they do? They also, the Temporally-Lieb representations involved are also give these restricted solid-on-solid models, which are another kind of integrable classical 2D system, or alternatively quantum 1D quantum chain. And there's a nice gadget for calculating the dimensions of these Temporally-Lieb representations, which come basically from using this fusion rule. Temporally-Lieb, or rather the quotient of it, so I'm just going to show you this. Another thing to mention here would be knot invariants. So I'm just going to show you how this works, because I think it's a neat thing which is easy enough that everybody can follow how this is done. And it's not usually included in a talk. So suppose that I start multiplying together these representations, V1 half, just I'm going to take a spin a half chain, and I'm going to throw out all of the spins that are too big. I'm only going to use diffusion, in fact, not just the ones that are too big, but the ones that don't obey this fusion rule here. Since we're only tensoring spin